Welcome to another episode of Foolproof Theology. My name is Chase Davis, and I'm your host. Hey, I'm grateful for William Wolf being here again today. He came on the show, I think, like right after he got on Twitter. I noticed him, and I was like, who is this guy? I got to get to know him. And thankfully, I've been blessed to call him a friend. So, William, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Yeah, glad to be back on here. Thanks for spotting me early. Keen eye for talent, I guess.
That's right. So I wanted to get basically for the listeners just some life updates. I mean, I think last time we talked, you were grinding away at Southern Seminary, and you were working your tail off to knock out, I think, an MDiv or a THM. So maybe give people some context as to where you are now.
Yeah, after living and working in Washington, D.C. for a decade, working in politics, I finished my time in the Trump administration and went to the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And I was there in Louisville, Kentucky for 2 years, which was always the plan, be there for 2 years, finish my MDiv, and look into doing further studies. I'm sort of working towards a THM right now. That's also a little bit on ice with a lot of other things that I'm doing. I do hope to finish that at some point and look at what it would look like to do a PhD. But for now, since I've left Louisville, Kentucky and moved back to my home state of North Carolina, I am working full time as the executive director for the Center for Baptist Leadership and Organization. I spent about 4 or 5 months behind the scenes building, which sort of led to its more public launch early this spring. So I'm doing that. I still write regularly for the Standing for Freedom Center out of Liberty University. And it keeps me busy for sure.
Yeah, you produce a lot of great content over there. I'm always impressed by your output. Whereas I want to write an article, I'm kind of slow with other responsibilities I've got, but you're like pumping out articles, it seems multiple times a week, and they're always very well written. So I appreciate the work you do. This Center for Baptist Leadership, I'm a contributing scholar. For listeners who don't know, I'll put a link to that in the show notes. So I'm honored to be part of it. And obviously I believe in it, but I wanted them to hear it from the executive director himself, why this new center is so important. The articles we're putting out there are very fun. One of my favorites has been by Michael Clary, who it was published, I believe it was published, and he called Acts 29 fake and gay. That warmed my heart, and that there's a publication out there that would publish such words. So why don't you share a little bit about the vision of the center and why it's important, not just for Southern Baptists, but also for evangelicalism as a whole?
Yeah, so the Southern Baptist Convention is America's largest Protestant Christian denomination. It has about 47,000 churches and about 14 million members. It's a critical institution in America, in American life. And the health of the Southern Baptist Convention matters, obviously, for us as Southern Baptists, but it matters for everyone else as well. You know, for example, Helen Andrews is, I believe she's Eastern Orthodox, and she is a contributing, one of the main editors at the American Conservative. And when she reached out to me and asked me to write a write-up of what happened at the Southern Baptist Convention last year, and we were talking about it, she's like, look, I'm not Baptist, but I get it. What happens to you guys matters for the rest of us. And then later at the end of last year, she actually picked that piece for her sort of best piece of the year, because again, the ramifications of what happens with the Southern Baptist Convention matters greatly. And so it matters on two levels. It matters theologically, and that's the most important level. Of course, if the Southern Baptist Convention becomes theologically liberal, well, it compromises and loses the gospel. And so then what gospel is going to be preached in all these thousands of churches? What gospel is going to be taken around the world as we have the largest missionary sending agency in existence, the International Missions Board? And so the purity of the gospel matters, but then also it has cultural impacts as well. If you look at all the other mainline Protestant denominations that have gone theologically liberal, well, they've gone incredibly woke. They've been captured by the cultural Marxists. They're flying the BLM, trans, pride, LGBT flags outside of their institutions. And what does that tell you? That is a captured institution. And so the Center for Baptist Leadership recognizes that right now in 2024 in America, the Southern Baptist Convention is actually a main target of the progressive left, of the cultural Marxists, of sort of the globalist crowd out there. They want to subvert and fracture it because they view it rightly as an obstacle to their progressive agenda. And so where the Center for Baptist Leadership comes in is we want to fight back against that. And so we sort of have three main lines of effort. We want to help revitalize the Southern Baptist Convention from within, dealing with all the doctrinal and theological and ecclesiological issues that we have going on at our convention right now, and equipping pastors and lay members and institutional leaders to deal with those so that we could have anti-fragile Baptist churches and seminaries and institutions. Then we also want to defend the Southern Baptist Convention and, again, equip those within it to defend it from the threats that are coming from attack, coming from outside, subversive actors trying to get in. And then finally, we want to, you know, step out into the public square in America as a better Baptist voice. Baptists, again, should have a much more, I'd say, prominent place in shaping American political conversations, American cultural life and ethos. And yet we've sort of abdicated that responsibility to Catholics, to Presbyterians. And so we want to sort of rally Southern Baptists to lead America politically, culturally, and theologically back out of this negative world and towards a better and positive and Christian vision for the 21st century.
Absolutely. Amen, brother. I think that's a great vision. That's why I'm glad to be part of it. So thanks for sharing that. I think, you know, one thing that it's a unique opportunity with the Center for Baptist Leadership is you've got, you know, what can be fun in the Southern Baptist. You've got a little sub networks, sub publishing houses, different organizations. And so I do enjoy that there maybe not diversity of thought, but I do enjoy that there is a place for you to kind of like land with a tribe, even within 47,000 churches. And I think this is an important one that's often overlooked, because many of the ones you'll see starting up today are very squishy. They're very, you know, third way, trying to kind of harmonize the secular narrative with the biblical narrative. And I don't think that's very helpful. I mean, I saw that Center for Baptist Leadership released a statement regarding the recent Trans Day of Visibility or whatever it was that was on Easter. And I was so proud to be part of the institution that would release such a statement that was so bold. I think you wrote that. Very well written. And so, yeah, very, very glad to be part of it, and hope to have something published over there very, very soon for William. You know, one thing that kind of comes up in this is with the Southern Baptist, one of these institutions, it's not a startup run by lay people. It's actually part of Southern Baptist funding many times, is the ERLC. And so my experience with the ERLC from an outsider, you know, they released some documents on marriage and sexuality after Obergefell. They help churches with facility use stuff. So they're kind of a public policy arm of Southern Baptist Convention. And so there's good stuff they've produced in the past. They have an opportunity. But what I've seen is they've squandered a lot. Not only have they squandered a lot, they've misrepresented the interest of Southern Baptists to ruling authorities, whether it's Brent Leatherwood in Tennessee or anything like that. I was just wondering if you could maybe give me some background to the being someone who's familiar, well-versed in politics, but also well-versed in theology and leading this new institution. I'd love some background on the ERLC, because maybe where it started. I think Richard Land might have started it. I don't know who that is. Maybe if you could provide some context that I could understand the ERLC a little bit better and where it is today, that would be really helpful for me.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission is the official sort of public policy arm of the Southern Baptist Convention. There was a previous committee, and I'm not going to get the name exactly right, so I'm not even going to try, like Baptist Joint Committee something, but there was a previous committee that was sort of tasked with dealing with political, cultural issues on behalf of Baptists, but it went completely woke. That was before woke was the word that we used. It was captured by the Jim Wallis Sojourners social justice liberation theology iteration of that woke theology back in the day. And so really? That eventually got shut. Yeah. So we had another iteration of the ERLC that went totally off the rails, social justice liberation theology, and coming out of the conservative resurgence, that got shut down. Good. And so then we got the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, you know, sort of as the second iteration of that. And now I've seen some people say that the job of the ERLC is really just to educate Baptists about these issues that are facing our nation. But that's not true at all. They also represent Baptists in Washington, D.C. They attend meetings with congressional staffers. They attend meetings with, you know, executive branch agency officials. Or as there's a famous picture with Russell Moore in the White House with President Obama, they go to the White House. So they're not just educating Baptists, they're representing us in the public square, or so they claim to be. I worked in Washington, D.C. you know, as a congressional staffer at another organization, Heritage Action for America. And so, you know, I was in very similar issues and meetings with the ERLC back in 2016, these coalition meetings. And I just was constantly underwhelmed. That's probably the nicest word I could use about their advocacy, particularly on some issues pertaining to protecting marriage after Obergefell. Their lead staffer on the marriage issue that would be in these coalition meetings with me was a man named Stephen Harris, who later went to work for the Biden campaign. So that's the type of people that were representing Southern Baptists in Washington, D.C. And of course, then you had Russell Moore, who was an adamant Never Trumper, very outspoken Never Trumper, even while the vast majority of Southern Baptists supported Donald Trump. So we had quite the disconnect between his leadership and the interests of Southern Baptists. And so that really is why the third line of effort for the Center for Baptist Leadership is to be a better Baptist voice in the public square. But I would say in a nutshell, the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, I think, is failing to live up to its mandate to defend conservative Southern Baptist political interests, and instead is defending very niche and, quite frankly, liberal interests of its president, Brent Leatherwood, or of a more respectable elite class of Christians who want sort of amnesty or, you know, immigration, you know, increased immigration. They always are sort of on the left side of the immigration issues, advocating for essentially what are unconstitutional red flag gun laws in Tennessee. And then they're nowhere to be found on the biggest fights of the day. Again, they've not yet issued a statement about Biden's transgender, you know, proclamation. And I ask, you know, if they can't say that, then what do we even have them for here? Which is a real issue in Southern Baptist life. Many people would like to see them defunded, but because I am not about burning it all down, I have a long-term vision where, you know, by getting the right people into positions of authority in the Southern Baptist Convention, particularly presidents, we ultimately replace the current trustee board of the ERLC to where they would hire, say, somebody like Andrew Walker to lead the office. And actually that it would be the office people want to work in. That's another thing too. I mean, this is a pretty public secret that their DC office is very understaffed and is inexperienced. And if you just look at the demographics of the staff, it's largely run by women. You know, do with that as you will, but it's a fact.
Yeah, and that does shape things. Yeah, that I was going to ask this later, but I think this is a good time to bring it up, because one of the unique opportunities in the Southern Baptist Convention, we already saw with the conservative resurgence, when something does go bad, the messengers and the convention that is Protestant and has a conservative heritage in America, a rich heritage in institutions, I believe it's six seminaries, six of the largest seminaries, that there's course correction power. There's the ability to change things. And so if we do want a kind of a new direction, one of the complications becomes, because it's so big and because there's so much bureaucracy and there's like committees of committees and trustees and all these entities. I mean, I listened to your podcast with John Whitehead just so I could, I believe that's who you talked with, about kind of like how all the different mechanisms work and all the meetings work and how the different levers of power work within the Southern Baptist, just so I could try to better understand. But it does seem like, man, this is really complicated. So I was wondering if you could maybe simplify it for me. Like, does the president have kind of like, you know, in the Southern Baptist Convention, we've got Bart Barber right now, but does he have the authority to replace trustees, to form committees, to appoint people to those committees? How does that work in the Southern Baptist Convention?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's a sort of a vast bureaucracy. That's right. But there is a rather streamlined and sort of simple target for change in the SBC. And again, if you're not in the SBC, you might want to pay attention to what we're doing here and consider how you could change your denominational rules and structures even to give more power to the lay people. In the 1960s, when the PCUSA was beginning to go liberal, there was an effort to form a Presbyterian lay committee to get lay members involved, because the lay members are always more conservative than the leadership in every institution, in religious institutions and political institutions. In every institutions, the constituents are always more conservative than the representatives and the leaders. But so in Southern Baptist life, we actually have that ability to change the direction through the voice of the lay members. And so the simplest pathway to reform in the Southern Baptist Convention is a multi-year process of electing a conservative president or a president with a different vision for the direction. And then that president gets to appoint the people to the committees that appoint the trustees. The Committee on Nominations then appoints the trustees, and it gets to vet them all. And so really, I'm telling people right now, some people are saying, well, we've been fighting this liberal drift, or you could call it a liberal resurgence, or as Michael Carlino put it in a recent piece for Christ Overall, we're being steered intentionally in a liberal direction. It's not a drift, it's intentional. If we want to fight that, we really need a pretty long-term horizon of about 5 to 10 years of getting a president who recognizes the issues to appoint the people who will appoint the people to the trustee positions that can change each entity. Because essentially what you need is you need the trustees at the entities to put the right people in charge. That's what happened with Southern Seminary, right? Everybody knows the story of Albert Mohler. How did somebody like Albert Mohler, this fire-breathing conservative, 33-year-old, become the president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary? Well, he became president in 1993. Chase, that was over a decade after the conservative resurgence had started. That's how much time it took to replace all the trustees there and get them all to the point where they would hire someone like Mohler. And so that's what we need in the Southern Baptist Convention. It's actually pretty simple. It really comes down to appointing, electing the right president. And that's really the message that people need to hear, is we have a problem. The Southern Baptist Convention is compromising on the Bible, compromising with liberalism, both theologically and culturally. But we have a solution. Show up, vote for a conservative president year over year over year, and then hold them accountable for the nominations that they make and the trustees that they appoint. And if you do that for 10 years, the Southern Baptist Convention will be in a whole different place, and that will be a better place.
Yeah, and it'll be better not only for the Southern Baptist Convention, but for Protestantism in America as a whole. Just maybe a historical question I might have is, my familiarity was Jack Graham back in the day. I went to Jack Graham's church, Presbyterian Baptist, was baptized there as a young man. Well, not man at that point. I was 8 years old, but, and so I remember him being the president. I'm wondering the last time after that I kind of checked in on who's the president was J.D. Greer, because he was formerly Acts 29, as am I. And I saw kind of the things he was saying, not only in the pulpit, but the things he was advocating for, the way he handled things. And I was like, that doesn't seem good. That doesn't seem like what would be representative of Southern Baptist. And so I'm wondering where did the drift start to come in? Was there a certain president you can kind of highlight as like, this was the one that kind of let down their guard a little bit too much? Or do you know anything about that?
Yeah, well, I think J.D. Greer really was the accelerant on the fire. I'm not sure exactly how much was, building up behind the scenes before he became the president now, 6 years ago. But also listening to Mark Devine's excellent Twitter space with American Reformer the other night, he made a very interesting observation that when it came to the young, restless, and reformed movement after Driscoll sort of fell by the wayside, the main leader was Keller. And Kellerism has really infected the SBC. And so the winsome third way sanctification of Christian voting for Democrats, hey, abortion's a big issue, but also poverty's a big issue too, as if those are somehow morally, comparable. They're not at all. So Kellerism was infecting all of American evangelicalism. And the SBC was a ripe target for that. And Acts 29 certainly played a role in that too, with Matt Chandler and J.D. Greer. And so we had this older guard of non-Calvinist conservatives in the Southern Baptist Convention. They're really the guys who led the fight, which segue, this is why Center for Baptist Leadership is a coalition builder. We are here to work with the Calvinists and the non-Calvinists, get them all together, and fight the shared threat of, theological and cultural liberalism. So we work with all of them. But there was this handoff to the first sort of young Calvinist in the SBC to take the helm, and that was J.D. Greer. And yet, as we're seeing, Chase, these young Calvinists who say they cared about the doctrines of grace and strong Reformed theology, they were the ones who were most susceptible to being infected by the Winsome Third Way model. And that's exactly how J.D. Greer led through what was ultimately 3 years of a presidency. Because of COVID, he got an extra year. And J.D. Greer made appointments to all these committees, you know, and to the trustees of people who were like that, sort of winsome to the world. J.D. explored renaming the Southern Baptist Convention. He was also at the helm during the height of the Houston Chronicle's sex abuse scandal break, and was very emotionally driven in his response to that. He was very woke on racial issues, and he's pretty woke on LGBT issues as well. We have an article coming out today at the Center for Baptist Leadership by contributing scholar Ron Rothenberg, talking about the unholy trinity of genderism, critical race theory, and Marxism. And that's really kind of what J.D. Greer brought to the table in the SBC. And that's when, under his presidential leadership, we got resolution number 9, affirming critical race theory as an analytical tool, which sparked a good and needed backlash within the convention. But then after J.D. Greer, we got Ed Litton, who was outed as a plagiarist the first week after taking office. And Ed Litton is also very woke on racial issues. That's just the best way to put it. Ed Litton essentially had to step. He didn't run for a second term because of how sort of scandal ridden his presidency was. And then we got Bart Barber, who, you know, maybe doesn't quite have as much sort of committed revolutionary instincts as Litton and Greer, but he hasn't done anything significantly to change the direction they've set us on. And he's also been opposed to the law amendment, et cetera. So we've had 6 solid years now of increasing liberal leadership in the Southern Baptist Convention, which has led us to where we are.
Yeah, and anytime you do that, I mean, these things happen quickly, as we saw with Obergefell. Now we've got all this trans day of visibility stuff. I mean, people used to joke about the slippery slope as a kind of straw man argument when I would raise red flags on issues, as if it was some kind of false concern. But it's like, we've seen it. I mean, we see how fast these institutions or these liberal movements, these neo-Marxist ideologies, quickly dissolve, erode, corrode just any sense of not just conservatism, but, you know, being proud of your traditions and heritage and upholding the truth of God's word. I was talking to somebody on Facebook the other day, and they're like, there seems to be a coalition in the United States. You've got a weird thing with, like, you've got these liberals who have walked away from liberalism, or maybe not walked away from liberalism, but they're starting to question. I even saw last night somebody who is active in the gay rights movement regrets ever advocating for gay rights because they see the trans stuff as so degenerate for what it is. And this is someone who's not a Christian acknowledging this. So you've got people like Barry Weiss or these other thinkers out there that are acknowledging this. And they were commenting like, well, yeah, but they're not Christian. So are we upholding Christianity, or are we upholding some kind of either conservatism or something like that? And I just said, look, any attack on God's creational design is an attack on Christianity itself. It erodes the foundations. And so I think it's hugely important, and it's indicative of how quickly things can change. One of the things that you mentioned, and I wanted to ask about this, because you saw that Houston Chronicle report, and the basic aim seemed to be to compare the Southern Baptist Convention to, like, the Catholic Church and the horrible sex abuse kind of scandals and cover-ups and that. And this is, you know, just in the media, the narrative has been set. This is what the Southern Baptist Convention is. They cover up abuse. Then you saw Russell Moore freaking leak a letter. And I've talked about this on my podcast before. For listeners, you can go listen to that. This was a letter that was written to be leaked. It was not some kind of, you know, just letting somebody know. It was a political maneuver. And he was in the committees that had power to shut down anything that would have been, could have been cover up. And so, but yet, William, you've still got people in the pews that maybe don't know all of this, that don't see that stuff. They just hear, you know, sound bites and clips, and they're like, oh gosh, that sounds really bad. And of course, we would all agree that that is bad. But I was wondering if you could provide some either context or help people understand that this is not what it seems to be. What are we supposed to make of this?
Yeah, so I've come to the realization that it's important to reject the Me Too leftist framing of what's gone on here in the Southern Baptist Convention. So I don't even want to engage in a framework or a discussion that uses the word crisis. That's not the right way to talk about this. The question is does the Southern Baptist Convention at any of its particular entities or institutions, the executive committee, you know, a state convention, or in a local church, are they using biblical standards of justice to deal with sins and crimes? And the report that you know, the Houston Chronicle's report and the subsequent investigations have not shown in any particular verifiable way that that's not the case. Are there instances here and there where particular Southern Baptist churches fail to deal biblically with instances of sexual abuse? Of course there are. Churches fail to deal biblically and judicially with issues all the time. But, you know, so what we need to do then is make sure that biblical justice is our standard. We need to make sure that we are there to care for the potentially abused. And we also need to make sure that we're there to protect the potentially falsely accused. And the way that the Southern Baptist Convention in many ways has dealt with this has been to throw out that entire other side of the biblical justice equation of due process, of the right to confront an accuser, of a right to, you know, do discovery and provide, you know, facts and explorations about the issue at hand. There have been churches and pastors who have had their names wrongly placed on lists, sort of labeling them as, you know, abusers or harborers of abuse. The executive committee of the Southern Baptist Convention was accused in that letter by Russell Moore of sort of, you know, harboring and creating this environment where all these horrible things were happening. And none of that was found to be true. And you're right. Those letters were written to be linked in the first episode of the Center for Baptist Leadership podcast, which will actually be a two-part series. I have John Whitehead tell the whole never told story of the letters with Russell Moore and his accusation of an apocalypse of abuse. And it was purely a political retaliatory effort from Russell Moore. And so, you know, here we are now many years later. And as John details, 10, 15, maybe even $20 million more dollars of offering plate money spent on consultants and investigations and, you know, wow, resources. And what do we really have to show for it? Which is, you know, not much. Is a child any safer in a Southern Baptist church today than they were 6 years ago? I'm not sure. But the reality is that child's pretty safe in a Southern Baptist church, right, as it stands, particularly compared to, you know, any other major institution, say like the public schools. Mark Coppinger has written on this, and he really dug into the data, and he has a piece on his own blog, and then we cited it in a piece at Center for Baptist Leadership. And the incident rate of abuse in Southern Baptist churches over the 20-year period that the Houston Chronicles article considers, over as he considers how many Southern Baptists it would have been, you know, how many Southern Baptist churches would have been in the SBC in the totality at that time, which he says, you know, I think was, or how many total Southern Baptists, he says like 28 million over that period of time. And the incident rate is like 0.0001 something. And so, you know, what happened was there were men leading an SBC at this time who were emotionally steered by these by this rhetorical play. And I believe it was intentional. I believe this was an intentional play to try to subvert and weaken the Southern Baptist Convention, and our leaders got played by it. And they led us in a Me Too, Church Too way, instead of trying to stand on biblical truth and biblical justice for both the accused and the accuser. And so, you know, I think now it's become very important in Southern Baptist Convention life to start telling the truth about this, to start rejecting this frame of crisis and pivoting towards, are Southern Baptists going to uphold biblical standards of justice or not?
Yeah, I think that's a great word, because, you know, we do see a lot of that steering in all sorts of, not just institutions, but also families. You know, it can be really hard to, in our day and age, to figure out what we're to do. I mean, the listeners can go back and listen to my conversation with Joe Rigney, and I've handed out his book already once, and I plan to hand it out many more times, because it's just so helpful to think about these issues. And we just seem to have a lot of leaders in institutions that are not really able, whether they're incompetent or whatever you want to say, they just don't seem able to handle these kind of things in a mature and biblical way. So thanks for bringing it. I look forward to that interview with Whitehead. And John is actually, is he on the ERLC, or is he part of that? Or what does he do in the Southern Baptist Convention?
Yeah, he's a trustee for the ERLC.
Yeah. So that's going to be a really key podcast. I'll make sure to share that and put in the show notes when it comes out for the listeners. Going back to kind of the president, circling back to kind of how you highlighted the need for a kind of 5 to 10 year view of reform and that kind of thing. With the current presidents, I mean, this kind of connects into what we were just talking about. They were on a recent Twitter space, and everyone said exactly what you said. There is no cover up. There is no crisis, all that kind of stuff, which I was glad to hear, not just, you know, because I want to be alleviated of false concerns, but also because I want people to speak the truth. And so I was glad to see all of them say that. I believe they did. Correct me if I'm wrong, William. I think they all admitted that there's no institutional cover up to one degree or another. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. Mike Keybone definitely had a different emphasis in his answers, and he continued to use the word crisis and sort of claim some hidden knowledge of having seen things that maybe the rest of us hasn't seen because he's been working on these committees that have been formed in response to it. But Jared Moore, David Allen, Clint Pressley definitely rejected the framing of this being sort of a systemic issue.
Yeah, okay. Then with the current presidents, I mean, I'm just thinking about any Southern Baptist, whether they're members or messengers or pastors that are listening to this podcast, can you give me kind of a lay of the land? Obviously, I'm kind of deferent as a friend of Michael Clary and Jared Moore, both been podcast guests. They're running as president, vice president. You know, can you give me some context for churches out there if they're going, well, yeah, I'm with you. I want to vote for a good conservative president in the Southern Baptist, which I can't imagine any Southern Baptist saying I want to vote for a liberal president. But, you know, they might be out there, I guess. But who are the main candidates? What are kind of, I guess, I would assume they have some kind of platform or angle. What do they represent? And who should conservatives be looking to vote for?
Yeah, so at the Center for Baptist Leadership, we're not going to be officially endorsing a candidate, but I will say here's the rubric that I think you should judge and make a decision off of as it stands today. And so as we head to Indianapolis, I believe that Bible-believing Southern Baptists should vote for a president who, one, enthusiastically and wholeheartedly affirms the law amendment, is committed to it and committed to its ratification and its implementation in the Southern Baptist life. The Credentials Committee, which is the committee in SBC life that adjudicates whether churches are in friendly cooperation with the Southern Baptist Convention or not, particularly would be the ones who do it on this issue of women pastors. The president needs to be committed to making it clear to that Credentials Committee and making appointments to that Credentials Committee that this is a top tier issue for Southern Baptists, that we need to end the rising egalitarianism that's taking over our convention. And so uncommitted, you know, unapologetically committed to the law amendment is the first one. Second would be unapologetically committed to financial transparency efforts. So Rhett Burns, a pastor from South Carolina, is pushing an amendment, sort of like the law amendment, we could call it the Burns Amendment, to require SBC entities to disclose 990 level financial details to churches in the SBC. This is institutional standard for nonprofits. It's not everything, but it's a lot more than we're getting currently. And so I would want to vote for a president who wholeheartedly supports that. Then the third issue I would say that you want to, you know, examine a president on would be their commitment to sort of appointing trustees who are going to do real reform work in the Southern Baptist Convention, that aren't going to be there for business as usual, that don't see it as just another step in matriculating up the platform, but are going to particularly focus on tamping down on wokeness, CRT, DEI, and feminism across SBC institutions at NAM, at our seminaries, at the ERLC, et cetera. You want a president who's committed to appointing really conservative, trustees. That would be a sort of a third major issue. And then fourth, I would say we want to look for a president who's going to be committed to strengthening the, the boundaries and bonds of SBC cooperation, not weakening them. We have this cooperation group hanging out there that might come back with recommendations that sort of slice and dice our confession, or we have to hold to some of these more strongly than hold to other of these. I want a president that rejects all of that. In fact, I would want a president who would want to actually lead us towards strengthening the boundaries of our commitment and our confession. So those are the main things that I'm looking for. And then fundamentally is just a president who knows what time it is. You know, 1 Chronicles 12:32, men of Issachar who knew what the times were and what to do. We don't, unfortunately, now is not the time for just sort of like, go along to get along. Everything's great. Look, emphasis on missions and church planting and evangelism is wonderful. And that's very important. But again, the vehicle for which we do these things is being corrupted, and we need to fix that so the gospel message is maintained. So that's the rubric. The people who are in the race so far are Clint Pressley from North Carolina, David Allen, Jaron Moore, Mike Keybone, and Bruce Frank, who just joined. Now, I know that Jared and David definitely support the law amendment and the financial transparency. I know that Clint supports the law amendment, he did not give a wholehearted endorsement of the transparency amendment in that recent Twitter space. Mike Keybone does not support the law amendment, and I think he does support financial transparency. And then Bruce Frank does not support the law amendment, and he is adamantly opposed to the law amendment. He just joined the race this week. Bruce Frank has preached at Saddleback, Rick Warren's church. Bruce Frank has been part of the abuse reform efforts in the SBC. And again, him and Mike Keybone very much want to continue to make quote unquote abuse reforms one of the main things we focus on, spend money on, spend time on in the SBC. And again, throwing biblical standards of justice out the window, creating lists, funneling more money, creating a permanent, unaccountable, independent organization that's going to function as like a abuse Politburo in the SBC. That's where Mike Keybone and Bruce Frank are. I know Jared Moore and David Allen don't support that. I'm pretty sure Clint doesn't support that either. But that's sort of the lay of the land currently. I really do think somebody like a Bruce Frank, I think it'd be fair to say, or Mike Keybone would be very similar to a J.D. Greer or an Ed Litton if they were elected.
I can see that. I'm only familiar with Mike Keybone because I've looked him up on Twitter, and obviously I would have disagreements with him, but I've never heard Bruce Frank. Is he an institution guy? Is he a pastor somewhere? Where is he at?
Yeah, he's a pastor out of North Carolina. And so he's part of the Greer crowd here in North Carolina for sure. Yeah. They've had some sermon clips of him circulating, talking about diversity and racial reconciliation. And I watched some of them, and some of them are fine, but it's just such a strange emphasis. I mean, he was asking his congregants to essentially, examine themselves for their hidden racism, which I think that's completely inappropriate to do. And so he's all in on the racial reconciliation thing, all in on the abuse reform continuing forever. And he's against the law amendment. And I think Mike Keybone's pretty similar to that too. So you have, I think, a pretty, again, I'm not making an endorsement of anybody. I'm just sort of laying out the facts where you stand. I think you have a pretty clear, shift in things as you go from Jared Moore to David Allen to Clint Pressley to Mike Keybone to Bruce Frank. And again, I would refer you back to that rubric: support the law amendment, support financial transparency, support conservative, reform-minded trustees, support strengthening the boundaries of our cooperation, and support being honest about the state of play with abuse reforms and how it's time to wind it down, tell the truth, return things to local congregations to deal with in a Baptistic and biblical way, and move forward as a Southern Baptist Convention.
Yeah, and the financial transparency piece is a real no-brainer to me. That thing, Rhett's done a great job there with what I've seen him propose and write, because I saw that problem, a massive problem in Acts 29 with, a $9 million budget to $2 million shortfall, yet they're taking a boondoggle trip to Cancun and nobody's being honest with, where is this money? Where is our money? We're giving our church, every Acts 29 church was on the hook for 2-3%. And that for us was like somewhere in the ballpark of 1,000 to 1,500 a month that we're giving to this institution. And we're like, okay, well, what kind of churches are we planting? Because we seem to be planting woke churches. And then you know, when they won't tell us that process, we're going, okay, well, where is our money actually going? And then you're looking at different, who's getting hired, family members getting hired and all that kind of stuff. And you're going like, I don't understand. Can we just get like a sheet or some kind of form? And they give out a budget, which, you know, being, if you run a business or run an institution or run a church or anything like that, when you look at that budget, you're like, well, these are just buckets of, you know, you could put money anywhere and call it this. And so I think the 990 thing just makes sense. I think a lot of people get freaked out because they're like, oh, you're reporting the IRS, and that is not what's happening. These are just asking for basic financial receipts for where, how are we spending money? And you know, I talked about it on, I think I did an interview on Forge and Anvil where I kind of brought up, look, I think about my wife's grandmother, Meemaw, and she's a faithful giver. She's been a Southern Baptist all of her life, and she's giving. She's, you know, she's a widow now, and she's giving to this church who then gives to the Cooperative Fund or the Southern Baptist Convention, and she's just trusting, you know, and I feel like she's being fleeced sometimes because we don't know where, who's getting paid what and where the money's being funded to. I mean, you talked about these abuse reform type initiatives, millions of dollars are being given as the convention leaders are being steered. And so it just, it's very, not just troubling. I would say it's like, man, that financial transparency would go a long way to restoring trust. Because a lot of people don't trust institutions today. That would just go a long way to restoring trust. I think I'm a big fan of the law amendment here. I think what I'm hearing from some, you know, solid, complementarian, faithful men in the pulpit, pastors of churches, I think there's kind of a rumor circulating that the law amendment is somehow would be, I mean, it passed last year, so I don't know why this concern is all of a sudden popping up. I mean, I have suspicions, but they're concerned that somehow the law amendment would create the Southern Baptist Convention to be more denominational than anyone wants it to be. It would remove the local autonomy of the local church. It would police things too hard. I mean, they raise some, and we can talk about, maybe not on this episode, but we can talk about another place in terms of the role of like, you know, women teaching in the church and the children's ministry. What do we do with that? You know, and so there's all the exceptions to the rule. What do you make of these concerns? Maybe get into some of the law amendment itself and what it actually does and why Southern Baptists should show up in Indianapolis and vote for it. And pass it again, which they've already done. Why should we pass it again with these concerns being raised?
Yeah, I just don't think that there's been any really legitimate concerns raised against it. No, so I think that all the law amendment does is reaffirm our already stated commitment to complementarianism, to male-only pastoral leadership. That's biblical. You know, the qualifications for elders, for pastors, for overseers in Titus 1 and 1 Timothy 3 are, you know, qualified men. And, you know, obviously we have 1 Timothy 2:12, I do not permit a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man. And what is teaching in the local church, if not the exercise of authority? It's always that. And why is it that? Because of the nature of God's word. When God's word is being expounded, it is authoritative. And so, you know, it says that, it puts in our Constitution, in our Article 3, that to be in friendly cooperation with the Southern Baptist Convention, you know, a church must only appoint, employ, or affirm a male as a pastor, elder, overseer, you know, as qualified by Scripture. And, you know, the genesis of this is the reality is that there is a lot of egalitarianism in the Southern Baptist Church. And if you ask yourself, well, how could there be so much Southern egalitarianism in the SBC? To which I say, well, have you heard of Beth Moore? Have you heard of Jen Wilkin? Have you heard of, you know, how we are having, have you heard of Saddleback? Have you heard of all these NAM church plants that are planting churches with Southern Baptist money that have a husband and a wife serving as co-pastors? And we've embraced the ethos of the world on this. And egalitarianism is liberal. It is destroying hierarchy, right? Which is the fundamental nature of what liberalism is, this great leveling. And, you know, I think of, you know, Conquest's three laws of politics, you know, any organization that is not explicitly right-wing will become left-wing over time. And in some ways, then the law amendment is an effort to just make us explicitly right-wing, if you want to use those terms, or biblical, which is right-wing on this issue, so that we don't become, you know, left-wing over, we don't become liberal over time, which we are. And so there's, I think it makes sense to so many of the people in the churches across the Southern Baptist Convention. But the opposition that's coming from some, you know, key voices or platform voices, I think is really just opposition that is not steeped in logic, and it's certainly not steeped in biblical theology. It's steeped in sort of emotional driven perception of how the world's going to take it. They're being steered by an imagined opinion of somebody outside the Southern Baptist Convention, or quite frankly, potentially even women in their own church, you know, who aren't going to like it. But they're bundling it all up into a broader DEI framework and saying, well, minority churches don't always do it like this, you know, and things like that. And so we've got a piece coming out here soon, hopefully, from Jason Gray, responding to sort of a laundry list of arguments against the law amendment. He calls them like the reasonable, the red herrings, and the, you know, the distractions, things like that. And so I'm confident we're going to ratify it again, but we need people to show up and to do that. And so like you, if you're listening to this, you're a Southern Baptist, plan to come to Indianapolis so we can ratify the law amendment, and so we can defend not only this key teaching of scripture, but this key point of what it means to be a Baptist. You know, it's always, to be a Baptist has always meant to affirm male only pastors. To fail to affirm that would say something about us, that we are becoming less Baptistic. During the downgrade controversy that Spurgeon went through, he said that, you know, the Baptist Union was becoming an indiscriminate collection of communities practicing immersion, right? And so if the SBC can't affirm male-only pastors, that's just another step along the way to becoming an indiscriminate community of, you know, people practicing immersion. That's not all there is to being a Southern Baptist.
Yeah, and I can't imagine, you know, when I look back, I was just reading the Baptist Faith and Message yesterday, and who all wrote that. I can't imagine any of the authors of that, which is the kind of document by which Southern Baptists kind of sign off and say, yeah, we're aligned here. I can't imagine any of them saying, well, yeah, we included women pastors. I mean, that's just nonsense to me. And, you know, I think there's a report over at American Reformer last year, the year before, regarding how many churches have compromised on this issue. And there's about 1,000, I think, something it's almost, like that.
So that was in how many women pastors are in the SBC. It's at American Reformer, and the estimate was about 1,800. Jeez. But, you know, Rick Warren did his own estimates too, and they were pretty high as well. Like when he was trying to make his case for staying in, he was like, look at all these other churches that have women pastors. It's like, well, that's not helping your case, Rick. Like, that's the problem, you know? And right. So it's indisputable. There are probably thousands of churches in the SBC that are operating outside of the boundaries of our confession. And so we have to ask ourselves, when it comes to our confession of faith, do all the words matter? Do some of the words matter? Or do none of the words matter? And on this issue in particular, I think we have to say it's all of the words matter on this issue. And so churches have a choice. Southern Baptist Convention is a freely, it's a free association. If you want to have women pastors, we can't stop you. But we can decline to allow you to continue to be a Southern Baptist church while you have women pastors. That's what it means to be a cooperative association with a Baptist. The Southern Baptist Convention is not a freelance club. As soon as you choose to join up with this, you're agreeing to abide by our confessional standards and our principles. And if you no longer agree with those, the thing that you should do is you should just leave. But right. If you're not going to do that, we can disfellowship you. Or the best thing that all Southern Baptist churches could do would be to repent and bring their church practices in line with scripture and our confessions.
Yeah, amen. And I think let's say you're a listener who doesn't have time to read the law amendment, which is not long. I mean, it's literally just kind
sentence.
Of, it's like just a, here's what it means. And so, you know, maybe you have concerns. One of the easiest ways to tell a lot of these things, we've talked about J.D. Greer on here. He came out and, you know, he pointed out why he wouldn't vote for it. And I'm like, well, if he's been wrong on all these other matters and now he's against this, that kind of tells you something about, you know, why you should support it. because the bad actors, the wrong players in the game, are against it. And that's exactly the point, is we should pass it, not to get them or something like that, but it just gives you kind of a lay of the land as far as, you know, why it's important to pass and that kind of thing. I mean, I like you highlighted, I've seen this in NAM church plants. I've seen this locally with those who claim Southern Baptist affiliation, who are affiliated with Southern Baptist. So like, this is a real deal, and it makes it really difficult to represent our faith and our Protestant heritage, particularly as Baptists, to the world when there's so much compromise left and right. And that also goes back to the 990 thing with NAM, is, you know, there needs to be clarity on what we're funding, who's getting funding, what they're paying for, so that one, rumors can be squashed, but also clarity can be provided, because that's what's needed today, is clarity. Well, William, this was a great conversation. I think we've covered everything I wanted to talk about and everything that maybe I've talked to other Southern Baptist ministers that they would be concerned about. Is there anything else you would want to encourage people? Obviously, show up to Indianapolis and vote. Anything else you would want to encourage people or point people towards?
Yeah, I think that I would say take a look at what's happened with Christianity today. If you are horrified by where Christianity today is currently, theologically, culturally, then you need to ask yourself, what can we do to stop the Southern Baptist Convention from ending up in the exact same position in the not so distant future? And really, one of the main issues that determines whether you stay strong or you go in, you know, down the slippery slope into theological liberalism, is complementarianism versus egalitarianism, right? Like, it's Christianity today was saying, you know, be complementarian at home but egalitarian at church, which, you know, that doesn't work. And it was founded, right? The Christianity today was founded to be a response, you know, to the, you know, secular liberalism and the progressive liberal theology of the mid, you know, 20th century. And now they've been captured by the same thing they were started. They were founded to oppose. And so if you care about the future of the Southern Baptist Convention, you know, and standing strong on the Bible and not becoming a byword in American Christianity, the way that Christianity today has become, then all the issues we're talking about here, the work we're doing at Center for Baptist Leadership, and coming to Indianapolis to vote this year is so important and should be clarifying. This is an act of generational stewardship, and it's something that you need to be a part of. So thanks for helping us have this conversation, Chase.
Absolutely. And I'll put a link to Center for Baptist Leadership. Anywhere else people should keep up with the work you do, obviously Standing for Freedom. I'll put a link to your Twitter bio. Anywhere else we want to plug, any other books or podcasts or anything else you want to point people towards?
Well, yeah, centerforbaptistleadership.org, and find us online at Baptist Leaders. Sorry, if you had said that, you'd cut out for a second, so I might be repeating it.
No worries.
And yeah, and then just continue to check out the work, of Christ Overall and American Reformer on these issues as we lead up to the convention. If you're trying to stay smart about SBC life, Christ Overall, American Reformer, Center for Baptist Leadership, Founders Ministries, and Conservative Baptist Network. Those are your buddies.
Excellent. All right. Thanks, William. Hey, if you're a listener and you enjoyed this episode, even if you're not a Baptist, I would encourage you to send this to a Baptist friend. Send this to a Baptist pastor down the street. You'll probably find one. There's a lot in America, and I think these issues matter greatly. These can be great conversation starters. William has presented a very thorough case for what we're trying to do here. And so appreciate you listening in. Share the episode with a friend. Give it a great rating. And sign up on the Patreon. You can get early access to all episodes over on the Patreon. Give me show prompts. Discuss with me all that kind of stuff. And until next time, we will see you.